From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Would you want to talk with someone who had burglarized your home? What about someone who had killed a member of your family? In our first half hour, we discuss restorative justice and how it's being used in Polk County and throughout the state. We'll talk with Jennifer Bertinoli of West Des Moines. In 1988, two young men murdered her father. Since then, she's met with them in prison. Also, Polk County Attorney Fred Gay and Director of Iowa Mediation Services Mike Thompson will be with us. Then in the second half hour, we talk about prisoner rehabilitation, how volunteers are creating writers' workshops and choirs in prison. That's all coming up this hour. First, this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Would you want to talk with someone who had burglarized your home? What about someone who killed a member of your family? In our first half hour today, we want to discuss the practice of restorative justice. That's and how it's being used in Polk County and throughout the state. Restorative justice is an approach to justice where offenders are encouraged to take responsibility for their actions and to repair the harm they've done by apologizing or, for example, returning stolen money or doing community service. Joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines, Jennifer Bertinoli. In 1988, two young men murdered her father in West Des Moines. Since then, she's met with the men who are serving life sentences for that murder. Good afternoon to you, Jennifer.
Good morning, Ben.
Also joining us in the studio in Des Moines, Polk County Attorney Fred Gay. He is also chief of the Juvenile Bureau there. Fred, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Ben.
Also joining us, Mike Thompson, Director of Iowa Mediation Services. We'll find out what that's about a little bit later. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Let me start with Jennifer. We want to focus on your experience with restorative justice, also known as victim-offender mediation. But first, can I ask you to share quickly the circumstances of your father's murder in 1988? You were 17 at the time?
I was 17. It was Saturday, February 13th. I was 17. He was a homosexual male. These men were invited back to the apartment that my dad and I shared, and they took a knife from our kitchen and stabbed him through the heart and sliced his face up, and the next morning I found him.
Did this happen in your presence?
While I was asleep in the next room, yes.
So you were unaware of it until you woke the next morning?
Exactly.
The motive for the murder?
Because he was homosexual. Okay. And they didn't like that lifestyle.
Both men are behind bars. Life without parole, I understand.
Yes, they are.
The first meeting, how was that initiated? You met one of them in 2001, I understand.
I did. That was Gary Titus, and I met Gary. He started the meeting. He had written a letter to the Department of Corrections and said that he wanted to meet with his victim's daughters. I have a sister. And usually Betty Brown said that that doesn't happen. Usually it's the victim that initiates it. But in this case, she thought she'd call me and ask if I'd be willing to do that.
What was his motivation for reaching out like that?
His motivation, which I learned about, was to get a commutation is what his motivation was. He felt that he did not do it and that at that time 15 years was long enough for him to serve a life sentence.
Mm-hmm. How much, before this meeting, how much contact had you had with either of the perpetrators?
None.
None, zero. Not in the courtroom, not a gaze in the courtroom or anything like that?
Well, probably in the courtroom in 1988, but up until from June was his trial of 1988 until 2001. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
What was your reaction upon hearing that he wanted to meet?
I was a little scared, kind of wondering why after all these years he wanted to meet with me. But I jumped at the opportunity because I thought it was an awesome opportunity.
Awesome for you? For what reason?
Awesome for me to finally get some answers as to maybe why it was, why they did what they did. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me to kind of know, you know, what my dad's last minutes of life were like.
Tell me about that first meeting.
That first meeting, he was at the prison in Newton, and it was very scary. I remember him coming in, and we sat at a table.
Do you have something? Have something separating you, as we tend to picture, or were you physically in the same room with no separation and a guard there?
Exactly, we were in the same room at a kitchen table, a board table. No guard in the room. It was a facilitator from Victim Services, Betty Brown, my husband, and myself, and Gary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What were those first words? What did you talk about?
I think we just kind of looked at each other, and I proceeded to tell of, you know, my version of that night and what he had left me to clean up, as how I see it, as to the mess that he left me with and how he changed my life forever.
And his reaction to that?
He listened. I don't think that he was totally sincere in his actions and his words. And I just felt that almost I was being re-victimized by him, from him sitting across from me. And it was kind of a lot to handle.
So that first meeting in 2001 with the first perpetrator, you came away with a bad feeling, like maybe that had been a mistake to do that.
Maybe not a mistake totally, because I did get some answers, but he didn't take responsibility for his actions.
That's what you needed to hear.
That's what I needed to hear. I needed him to tell me that, you know, he was really sorry. It was a mistake. He's learned from it. And, you know, he's sorry that he changed my life and his life as well.
Mm-hmm. You had another meeting with the other man who helped commit the murder of your father.
Yes.
That went better, I understand. This is years later, 2006.
This one, you know, I had grown a lot and I had learned a lot through that first meeting with Gary. And in 2006, we went down to Fort Madison, where Billy was serving his life sentence. That was about 17 and a half years into the murder. And he took full responsibility for what happened. That one was also taped. The Arts and Entertainment Channel and Oprah had picked it up. And so I have that one on tape, which I think is very important, because I can go back and watch it and watch his words. And it's not just from my memory.
So it was, in this case, with Billy, heartfelt.
I feel it was heartfelt and sincere. Yes, I do. And mm-hmm. He took responsibility. And that, I wouldn't say that, I mean, I think it was a really good experience for me, and I think I was given a gift. And I'm so grateful for that.
What do you believe victim offender mediation can resolve?
Inner peace. I think inner peace with the crime that has been put in your plate or been dealt to you.
Since those meetings, you find just daily life easier.
I do. I have five children, and I find that I have a lot of peace because of that. Yeah, I do.
Is this sort of mediation for everyone, or would you say you have to be very selective about the cases?
I would say that not everybody is like at the same spot that I'm at. So I would say that it kind of depends on the person. You know, people would ask me, how could I sit in a room with them, knowing what they had done to my dad and how they changed my life. And they have anger and they don't understand. And it's just something that I had to do to become a better person and to kind of put it aside, never to forget it, but to just be okay with it.
Jennifer, I want to turn to Fred Gay, Polk County Attorney, Chief of the Juvenile Bureau there. Fred, we've heard this story here. The victim offender mediation, I understand, is only one practice of restorative justice. Talk about how this fits into the larger concept of restorative justice, the story we've just heard.
Well, good question. I would say it's probably the core practice of among many restorative justice practices. If I could give you just a little bit of history, in 1991, the county attorney's office started at a low level doing what we called victim offender mediations. The program is actually victim offender reconciliation program. And we had an existing neighborhood mediation center at the time, had that for over a decade. So we had trained facilitators that we could call upon, including Mike Thompson here with us today. And we started with low-level offenses. But within a few years, we were doing the very kinds of cases that we've talked about, surviving family members of homicide victims and sexual assaults, armed robberies, et cetera. So, and I need to give you that history because that is almost exclusively what we did in the first few years was have these meetings.
But those few years were when?
In the early to mid-90s. And by the mid-90s, by the way, the Polk County judiciary, the judges were ordering victim offender mediations as part of sentencings with the requirement that the offender participate if the victim wanted it. And so that was a big step for the courts to recognize the value of it. And victims certainly don't want it all of the time. In fact, they probably don't want it more than half the time. But for various reasons.
Is your job then to help convince them or just simply to evaluate if this is a candidate that might benefit from this practice?
Well, we have a well-trained staff now. We actually have a restorative justice center within the county attorney office, and we have 8 or 9 full-time what we call victim liaisons who are trained in restorative practices and principles. And so they talk at length with both the perpetrator and the victim just to see where they are, as was suggested, to see if this is an appropriate time. It's our belief that there's no crime, hypothetically, in which there cannot be a victim offender meeting. But it is a matter of determining whether the parties are ready. For example, I've seen sexual assault cases where the victim was approached and said, absolutely not, there's no way I can sit across from from this man. And 2, 3, 4 years later, we'll get a call from the victim who will say, you know what, I need to sit across from him. I need to let him know what he did to my life, you know.
So sort of what Jennifer talked about, there would be a period in which you would be open to this, and then before that perhaps not. And the person who was victimized has to, as of course, have the say here.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And for the most part, it depends on the offense and how intrusive it was.
Fred, we have to take a short break.
Yeah,
we'll be back in just a moment. Polk County Attorney Fred Gay with us, Director of Iowa Mediation Services, Mike Thompson with us. We'll ask him how he fits into this picture of restorative justice when we come back. Jennifer Bertinoli with us. Two young men murdered her father in 1988, and since then she's met with them in prison. We'll find out more about restorative justice when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, talking in our first half hour about restorative justice. In our second half hour, we'll talk about prisoner rehabilitation, some unique programs taking place in Iowa prisons. We have Jennifer Bertinoli with us, Mike Thompson with us, and Fred Gay. Let me go to Mike Thompson. We haven't heard from you yet, Director of Iowa Mediation Services. Iowa Mediation Services, a statewide nonprofit established in the mid-'80s. Explain how your organization, Mike, fits into restorative practices here.
Well, our program started in the mid-'80s doing other kinds of mediation, and at some point we decided in the early 90s to work with Polk County, and we helped design the whole sense of what a restorative justice third party would look like. A number of our staff did the work with them, and they were the volunteer mediators. We've done a lot of the work that originally started on some of the difficult cases. And again, like Fred said, we started out with simple cases that didn't appear to be intrusive, but at the same time, anybody being victimized feels that they've been intruded upon. And there are some people who are tremendously intense, and you have to deal with that intensity in this session. And there are other times when the offender, as Jennifer said, doesn't really have the capacity to express responsibility or shame for the crime. And then the third party's got to help the victim not be re-victimized. And that's really a crucial part of this. So what we were really trying to design is a program by which we could make sure to protect the victim, but at the same time help people come up with mechanisms by which this victim-offender approach would be helpful.
I'm imagining in our audience today, of course, people who are victims of crime listening to this. Suppose it has struck a chord, and what should someone who has been a victim of crime ask themselves, him or herself, to know whether this might be a venue to more inner peace?
Well, is there something they would like to say to the offender? Is there something they'd like to hear? And again, I think the thing that they almost always want to hear is, why me? Why did I get picked? And it's really crucial when you get to that question. Sometimes they get an answer they don't want to hear. Sometimes it totally is random. And that's pretty scary for that victim, because they could be in that position again. And that's what I think a lot of them are searching for, is that inner peace and some certainty. And so I think a large part they're trying to calibrate, what do I do? But I think there's a phenomenon that goes on in these sessions. Typically what happens is, when you develop a dialogue, I think it creates empathy on the part of the victim. And I think they start having some empathy for the offender, not in the sense that they're forgiving them, but in the sense that there is a need for them to talk to that person and find out why they did it, what can be done about it, and almost always turns around in some ways where the victim expresses, what can I do to help you too? So it doesn't just become, what does that offender have to do? And I really think it's an interesting dynamic you have to allow people to play out.
Mm-hmm. We have just 5 minutes or so left in this conversation. So much to discuss here, but because we only have a few minutes, I want to turn to Fred Gay again. Your county attorney's office has just begun a mediation program, I understand, in all five of Des Moines' public high schools based on the idea of restorative justice. Tell us about it.
Well, we've done what we call school-based mediations for quite some time, but it's been on an as-needed basis. And so we would get calls when there were disputes or altercations in the schools. It could be middle schools as well, and even elementary schools. But what we were discovering is sometimes out of sight, out of mind. So we approached the Des Moines School District in the fall and suggested to them that we could staff each of the five high schools in the district one morning a week with a trained mediator from our office, and that we would be there without fail every morning. So, for example, I was at Lincoln this morning and did two mediations beginning at 10 o'clock. And it's been very, very well received.
What sort of cases are you dealing with at the high school level?
Well, it's amazing. And Mike is chuckling here. He can just imagine he's done some of them. But, of course, with texting and Facebook and all those kinds of electronic forms of communication, these kids are living in a world that is not real. And so that they take chances and they conduct themselves in a way that they would not do face-to-face. But eventually they do end up face-to-face, and so anger and resentment has built up oftentimes because of the communication that's taken place in cyberspace. So both mediations I had this morning, one was with four girls who were ninth graders, and another one was two boys, one in 10th and one 11th, and both of them had cyberspace implications that really sort of rubbed salt in the wound, and assaults occurred in both places, in both instances.
So had you not been able to intervene here, spin this out, what might have been a consequence of not being able to step in this way?
Well, each of the five high schools in Des Moines, as well as many other high schools, have what are called school resource officers, and they're on site. And there were some serious assaults in both of these instances, and the school resource officer was involved and would probably have made a referral to juvenile court services, and we may have ended up in court with these young people. Mm-hmm. But the school resource officer is an excellent one and recognized that if we could get to the bottom of things through a mediation that is restorative justice based, that we might be able to diffuse things, hopefully permanently, and keep kids from having records, and hopefully they'll get along in school.
How is this, Fred, how is this different than what had been happening in high schools in Des Moines prior to this? Wouldn't the people, the counselors, be looking to head off confrontations in this way anyway?
Well, I would say that the difference is, and Mike can attest to this, the difference is mediators are able to sit for a long time. A good mediator can sit for a couple of hours if need be. And so when school personnel get involved, I mean, they're accustomed to wanting to have something taken care of in 10 or 15 minutes. And quite frankly, you don't get to the bottom of things. With the two boys that I had this morning, it wasn't until almost an hour had gone by that I found out they were holding back that it had to do with a girl. And with the four girls, it was about an hour into it when we found out that it had to do with a boy, you know. So you have to be patient and have the time to keep peeling back the onion.
Time consuming, it sounds like, well worth it, though. Budget cuts, any concern of yours, the state budget cuts?
Well, you know, we make room. Mike Thompson's people trained many attorneys in our office to be mediators. And so we free up our court schedules to be able to plug people into these schools. And so the budget cut doesn't affect our office, I keep my fingers crossed, at least at this point in time.
How unique is this program in high school and at the state level in the nation?
Well, I'll tell you, I went to the International Restorative Justice Conference in October. It was out in Pennsylvania, and 90% of the presentations and breakout groups had to do with restorative practices in schools all around the world. And what people are really beginning to realize in large numbers is that schools are communities, you know. And unless we deal with these matters within the school community, you know, we're going to have a lot of problems. And so there's an awful lot of emphasis being done. And there's some wonderful programs being done, carried out, not just in the United States, but in New Zealand, Australia, England, you name it. Many, many countries are focusing this kind of approach within the school systems.
We have just a minute left. I'd like to turn in the final minute to Jennifer Bertinoli. Listening to this conversation, I want to ask you the same question that I asked, I think, Mike Thompson a minute or so ago. Someone out there has been victimized. You were victimized in the worst sort of imaginable way. Your father was murdered. What do you say to victims out there who have not been able to talk to the perpetrators? How do they know they might be ready for this and they want to find out more? A nagging feeling that there's something unresolved?
Yes, a nagging feeling. I know that I wrote down a lot of questions, excuse me, that I've been wanting to ask them to maybe call Polk County Victim Services and talk with somebody there and see if they're, you know, at a level that they could go do that without feeling like they're re-victimized.
Okay, let's end up with some contact information. Fred Gay, how do people find out more about this program in Iowa, no matter where they are in Iowa?
Well, they can certainly call the Polk County Attorney Office. Our general number is 515-286-3737, and they can ask for our Restorative Justice Center and get some very good information about what's going on here. And we have access to information about other programs around the country as well.
Polk County Attorney Fred Gay, thank you for joining us. Jennifer Bertinoli and Mike Thompson, thank you as well for coming into our studio. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about prisoner rehabilitation, some unique programs taking place behind bars here in Iowa, including a prison choir. This is the prison choir at Oakdale Prison. We'll find out more about it and also about a writer's workshop behind bars when we continue. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Some recent studies suggest that popular antidepressant drugs, such as Zoloft, Paxil, or Prozac, are no more effective than placebos and may even be worse. Tomorrow on this show, we look at that emerging controversy with Dr. Robert Robinson, head of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. Also, Margaret Stout of NAMI, Iowa, will join us, and a licensed psychologist. What to make of the depressing news about antidepressants tomorrow on The Exchange during this hour. Today, we're talking about restorative justice, the whole concept we heard in the first half hour. Now, I want to turn our focus a little bit to the topic of rehabilitation or prisoner education and some unique new programs taking place behind bars here in Iowa. Joining me now in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Mary Cohen, she is an assistant professor of music education at the University of Iowa, a joint appointment with the College of Education and the School of Music. She is also director of the Oakdale Community Choir. That's a choir involving community volunteers, students, and prisoners at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center, commonly referred to as Oakdale Prison. Mary, good afternoon and welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us in our studio, Matt Gilchrist, assistant director of the University of Iowa Writing Center. He helps lead the Writers' Workshop at Oakdale Prison, a program that began just this last August. Matt, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having me.
Mary, if I could start off with you, tell us about the prison choir. How many choir participants do you have, and what is the mix there, volunteers, students, inmates?
The choir currently has 25 inside singers or offender singers and 28 community singers. So each week the community singers join me in the prison. We walk in together and meet the prisoners, and we rehearse together every Tuesday evening.
In the facility at Oakdale. I understand you recently celebrated your one-year anniversary.
That's correct, February 2nd.
So what do you look back with most pride in this last year of your choir?
Well, I guess I'm more appreciative than anything. Very appreciative of the staff at the IMCC, the Warden Craig and Kevin Weideman, treatment manager. Mm-hmm. All of the folks at IMCC have been very supportive. The Kristen Garvin, who meets with us every week to come into the facility. The correctional officers have been very supportive of bringing a program that they had never had at that particular facility in, so we could make choral singing together and do a lot of learning activities.
So what gave you the idea to initiate this program?
Well, I've been researching prison choirs during my doctoral program at the University of Kansas for a number of years, and when I began my appointment here at the University of Iowa, I had the opportunity to incorporate my research and teaching with the choir. So I was thrilled to have the support from the Music Education Department to be able to initiate this project, mm-hmm. and to be able to delve into research with choral singing in prison contexts in more depth.
Mm-hmm. How unique is this in the country or in the state?
Well, prison choirs themselves may not necessarily be unique, but the fact that we have community singers joining prisoners in the prison, that part is unique. And the fact that a volunteer is coming in to the prison to direct the choir is unique, because mm-hmm. there are a number of choirs that are used for religious services, for worship within the prison, or conducted by prisoners themselves. So having an outside member come in and lead a chorus is fairly unique. I mean, there are a handful around. I can talk about that if you want.
We have a choral piece recorded. In fact, this is a poem, I understand, written by an inmate at Oakdale that you put to music. It's called In My Mother's Eyes. Before we hear an example, a little excerpt from it, tell us about it. How did this come to be?
This past summer, we did a songwriting project with the choir, and I gave the prisoners and the volunteer singers a variety of tips on songwriting, because we have an actual writing component, which we can talk about a little bit later. So one week, I shared the first song that I set to music, a different tune called Crossroads. And at the end of that rehearsal, another prisoner came up to me with a poem and said, "Would you please put this to music?" Mm. And so this was just the second time that I'd set something to music for this particular choir. And I smiled and said yes and thought, when will I have time to do that? But I did. Well, what happened is I took the poem home, read it, and just broke down with the power of the text was very remarkable. So it took me quite a while to set it, well, within a week, but I could only do it about a line at a time because the lyrics are so powerful. And basically the story, this particular prisoner was reflecting on his last interaction with his mother in the courtroom when he was sentenced to go to prison. And he reflected on the look she gave him that day and just reflected on how he had hurt her, and expresses this very beautifully in the text. So I took the words and I immediately thought meter in three, so it has kind of a lullaby feel, mm-hmm. and D minor to give the hauntingness of the text a melody that mm-hmm. connects to that.
I want to listen to it in a minute, but because it's a little bit hard to understand, it's a choral, would you read some of the lyrics that are from this song?
Sure. The chorus, "In my mother's eyes, I can do no wrong. I'm in her thoughts.